Ama şöyle bu da, ama şöyle Dharma, ama şöyle Sangha. Good morning, sound check. We're good.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. We just did term opening ceremony. And I want to, this is something that's been happening for several thousand years, that kind of a ceremony, different versions of it. And I wanted to read two little like opening words from Dogen on the occasion of a term opening. The first one: I tie up bags of patched robe monks and play with them as a ball. Within this bouncing, numberless Buddha ancestors appear. I keep them to give to the monastery so that they can raise horses and oxen. That's it. As a patched robe monk, it sounds uncomfortable. And Dogen is displaying a lightness, right, with that discomfort, showing confidence that it has a purpose. Sounds accurate. It sounds like Ango to me. The next one's a little bit longer, and I'll add a little explanation as it goes. 5 or 6 cups of Buddha ancestors' mind and marrow is called 90 days of peaceful abiding. 100 or 1,000 eyeballs of patched robe monks are called 3 months of protecting life. So that's the intro, talking about the next 3 months of effort. In medieval Japan, Ango happened in the summer. Nowadays, we do two, one in the spring, one in the fall. So from now until the end of Urohatsu, we're in this particular container. Clouds settle on the mountain like children with their father. The water is clear in the ocean assembly like younger and older brothers together. Bones and flesh practice together. Dragons and snakes make a single endeavor. Think that's similar to what I spoke to after the ceremony. The sharing of intention is so valuable. It's why we did the, why we listened to everyone's vows, allowing that sense of deep harmony to become more obvious. Dogen continues. Buddhas uphold and maintain this eating of rice and wearing of robes. People protect this event, pacifying mind and establishing their lives. Ancient Buddhas from the 10 directions settle down like rocks with their entire bodies committed to never departing. All the pillars with their entire substance are wood in disciplined restraint. So this is some of Dogen's sense of humor. This is a series of puns in Japanese. Dogen is playing with different names for Ango. Sitting cushions bear fruit, which ripen all the time. Flowers open on a staff, fragrant every day. At this time, the demon Papaya sees Buddhas and laughs joyfully. A rigid stone nods its head in a noisy and is noisy with delight. At what? He laughs at a flower opening and it makes a delighted clamor at a sitting cushion bearing fruit. Dogen's closing with these images of enlightenment, of celebration, holding out a carrot to encourage us all. So it's hard, and there's something important about that. There's something worthwhile there. The original kernel of this talk came from a drat meeting. It's our teacher's circle. Several teachers noted that some Sangha members bringing coming to Sanzen with confusion about how to meet discomfort, especially in meditation. And so in that conversation, Dratt decided that the Sangha needed a Dharma talk on dealing with pain. And no one at the moment, no one was really fired up to do that. But I figured I could get within splashing distance and still have a talk I wanted to hear. Then Shinyu kind of snuck one in last week looking at the five remembrances. So we sort of got it covered twice. But as it turns out, suffering is still relevant. So slightly different slant today. What I'm looking at specifically is how this tradition has held up ascetic practices and how that translates today. So when the Buddha died, his most senior surviving disciple was Mahakashyapa. We chanted their name today as Makakashyo. And the epithet that he was given was greatest in discipline. Right? He was famous for the rigor of his ascetic practices. And ascetic practice in Buddhism is largely about not contorting, right? About letting one's daily life, allowing it not to be shaped by preference. So at that time, when Mahakashyapa was around, those practices consisted of wearing only rags that were found on the ground, right? Eating only what food was offered, only sleeping on the ground, meditating in the wilds, always teaching when asked, and having very few possessions, right? Really simple renunciate life. It wasn't actively trying to cause any difficulty. It's not like trying to make it harder, not trying to cause pain. It was just not avoiding the natural difficulty that arose as part of life, part of embodiment. And I would say that's still quite relevant. We're still very much shaped by that legacy in terms of how we practice. The world's quite different 2,500 years later, and the same questions remain of what's needed, what's available, how might small self be finding this way into the equation. And variation of how these questions are answered shows something about our individual approach to it. So during Angu in ancient India, which they did also in the summer during the rainy season, the monks would congregate into viharas and practice together. And during the rest of the year, they were alone or in small groups. Later in India, like larger institutions develop, and in China, monasteries was the standard practice environment. And so these questions about rigor and practice of how tight is the form, how hard are we trying, were answered not just individually, but also communally. When we're practicing with others, how we answer those questions changes, but they're still the same basic questions. The temple here works at discerning how to draw that line. What's most supportive of the flourishing of practice, right? For an individual and for the Sangha as a whole. We want to accommodate a wide variety of needs. And we also don't want to sacrifice the clarity of the container for preference. So we serve, like alternatives at meals, if there's analogies, people can get fed. And we don't modify the menu on sashimi because someone doesn't like a particular vegetable, eggplant, or mayonnaise, or whatever it happens to be. Most of our attendees feel like they're giving up some measure of comfort, some measure of preference when they do sashimi or come here for a Sunday, right? Regardless of posture, sitting here for 1 to 3 hours is probably less comfortable than the recliner in your living room, right? But hopefully it's approachable, right? You're all here, the room is full. It's much more comfortable than many people have access to. What's needed? it's useful to look at that from a variety of lenses. What's needed, like big picture globally, what's needed personally? It's not a physics or biology question. It's a practice question. Over the course of our lives, we've built up all these answers, all these kind of heuristics for identifying what we need and how we get it. We have strategies for getting through the week, for getting through a conversation with our parents, for getting through rush hour traffic, right? And if we look with equanimity, we find that some of that's true and some of it's not. I'm fascinated by how random it is, right? I notice myself believing something and I like go digging and like the route can be so random, can be so whatever. There's a time when I was 12 maybe, and I was swimming out in this big lake and I got a cramp and I was flailing and some dude came by in a canoe and pulled me out of the water. And he said, "Eat more bananas." I was so impressed with like my frailty in that moment. And like, I don't know what happened, but my memory, he lifted me out with one arm and, who knows? But like, he was strong. And somehow that lodged in a particular way. And I still have a habit of when I'm experiencing some like physical deficiency of like looking for causality with food or nutrition. Right. And it's not true. It's just anxiety around scarcity. Right. Yes, like potassium relates to muscle cramps, but there's no lack. It's just like it's super common to feel physically inadequate in this culture. And that's mostly delusion. That's mostly self happening. It's not a pattern that I want to govern how I relate to myself or food or, life. So seeing through those things. It's a silly example, but that's the point, right? These silly things have enduring effects when they're not noticed. And ascetic practices are ways of helping us notice the filters that we're using, right? Help us see those accumulated habits for what they are, for just accumulation, extra. Not deeply true. So equanimity, right, that settledness, non-opposition is really important for clarity around this and doing this kind of looking. I said that practice here is approachable and is more comfortable than many people have access to, most of the world's population. I'm not trying to like privilege shame us by pointing that out. And I'm not saying that ascetic practice is unlikely or difficult in 21st century America. Part of equanimity is not taking it personally, is being careful about comparison. It's one of the, like, there's a real edge in practicing with others. We're seen, right? We see others. It gives tremendous leverage and it's wildly uncomfortable, right? Being known. So I want to talk a little bit about how ascetic practice is perceived, right? How do we do our own practice and trust that? I remember my first Sijiki. 28 years ago, I had that morning, at that time, Sijiki started on a Friday evening. And that morning I had badly sprained my ankle. And so I showed up with like a makeshift crutch and I was in a lot of pain. And I assumed and projected a lot of external pressure to not show it, to tough it out. It never occurred to me not to come. Right. I said I didn't adapt my posture. I didn't elevate my leg. I didn't do anything that would have been smart. I'd leave the crutch outside because it had touched the ground, and people take off their shoes when they come inside. And so I just sort of like hopped or jumped around when I was, when I was inside. I didn't want to get into trouble, right? In my first retreat, at some point during retreat, someone took the crutch away because I left it on the porch, and they probably thought it was a stick. And I thought, I'm in trouble. And I wasn't allowed to use it, right? So, yeah, we've all been there. So, A, like I can be pretty dumb, right? B, I had more than a little bit of like wanting practice to be hard so I could prove something, right? There was that need there. And I was earnestly trying, right? I was confused. I was available for practice. I just didn't know how to do it skillfully. So it's hard. It's hard not to compare. It's hard not to project. We're wired for it. We're mammals, right? And Zen doesn't exactly make that easier. Like Zen stories are chock full of stories proving the protagonist's ascetic credentials, right? Wei Kei cut off his arm to prove his sincerity, right? That's a skillful means failed by Bodhidharma, but it's there. It's a story. There's so many stories of long sitting, of enduring harsh conditions, right? It's just like a guarantee. When I was, my first decade of practice, I did a lot of sesshin with other groups, and I felt a lot of pressure to prove, to like represent Dharma Rain's practice, right? And show our rigor and sit more yaza and whatever. And, being able to sit upright through a night is a skill, right? It's nice to know you can do it. Occasionally, it's organically useful. It arises naturally if we've cultivated that capacity. We can make use of it, but it's also kind of showy, right? It's very vulnerable to selfing. It's very vulnerable to like, ah, this makes me a worthwhile Zen student, right? And so I'm pretty wary of that. There's some sesshin that we do where we allow or invite yaza, but for most of them, in contrast, we encourage people to like instead use the rigor of following the schedule of everybody kind of doing the same thing, of not differentiating, not proving in that way, which is a different hard practice. There is something really important about hard practice, ascetic practice. Examining the relevance of our preferences, being able to bow to circumstances are things that we need to do extremely frequently in life. Trying to prove something with that is a miss, right? It's a misread of the Zen stories. It's getting caught by self-doubt. Hello, fly. It's being confused about worth. I see people walk into the temple and tighten. Right? There's a wariness of doing it wrong. And that's an unfortunate legacy of telling Zen stories. That's the miss happening. That's not understanding immaculacy. When we're afraid, we see less clearly. We're looking for threat, and so there's more charge than is usually helpful. Maybe that's a bear over there, right? Sometimes that physical charge, that tension in the sympathetic nervous system is genuinely helpful. But right now, it's just a taiko. On the first hit, it might be a bear. There's a lot of jump in the room. But the vast majority of the time, our tension is caused by past karma just playing out, projected on our current situation. We're here because we want to see clearly. I want a training environment where all of us feel deeply safe that this, so that this clarity can happen. And deeply safe is not the same as comfortable. But comfort is one route into perceiving that safety. It's tricky. The asceticism, the rigor that I'm interested in is subtle, right? It's rarely that which is easily visible. I'm much more curious about the esoteric, the internal aspect of this rigor. How are we holding our attention internally? So much comes down to basically the process of Zazen. How available are we moment by moment to experience our life exactly as it is? That's rigor. That willingness. When we're not quite available, you know, we tend to reach for obvious things. We compare, we judge, we distract, right? We do something often cognitive to create a little more distance, to somehow mediate that experience so it's a little bit less intense. And often that strategy is tragic, right? And that attempt to make a moment less intense, we're actually causing more suffering over time. So this rigor of willingness to meet our experience directly, our actual life, is a lot less obvious, right, than sitting through the night. But it's so relevant, it's so constant, it's so pervasive, right? That opportunity. Are we willing to experience this? Are we willing to experience it with more depth? It keeps unfolding if we sustain awareness reliably. When we're under the influence of fear of past karma, we're probably unable to access that depth, that continuing unfolding. As we work with our karma, as we get more and more familiar with our likely bailouts, we gain curiosity. We can tolerate more of that intensity without needing to reference ourself. So you're sitting here, your back hurts or something hurts. Do you move? There's no enduring answer. I saw that. There's no right answer that can be handed to you. There's forms, right? But all forms have to get interpreted in a context for a person. What I want is for us each to take responsibility here, to assess who we are in a given moment, what's needed. Generally, if contraction is present as part of your experience, we need to find more ease. What am I telling myself that makes this fraught, that makes this dangerous? Am I sure that's actually a bear? And if ease is present, go deeper. Our natural state is to be part of this environment, connected to where we are, with appreciation, joy, ease, curiosity. That's most natural, most innate. Awareness is vibrant. We have 2,500 years of this ascetic inheritance, inviting us inwards to know ourselves with ever more depth. And we are also heir to 3 billion years of evolutionary wisdom, right? We are inherently resilient critters. Our bodies are really good at meeting stress, change, impermanence. If it's too much, we tighten. If it's much too much, we go limp. If it's approachable, ease and joy. The pivots between those states are we can learn. We can be soft and flexible and connected to that which is around us. Taking responsibility is cultivating this adaptability, this equanimity, this willingness to experience. It's working to dissolve the accumulated karma that artificially keeps us tight and makes that a bear. We can do this within ourselves, and we can do it with our families, with our neighbors, with our temple. It's always inviting us deeper. Welcome to Ango.
We'll now have a period for questions and comments. If you're in the room, please raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you. Please say your name before you speak. And please hold the microphone at a 45-degree angle, just a few inches from your mouth. If you're on Zoom, you can type your question or comment into the chat box and Tony will read it for you, or you can put your name into the chat box and Tony will unmute you. I'll start. This is Conan. I feel like recently I was scared by a lot of bears that weren't bears. And there's just an after effect from that in my system. And I have been the last few days noticing it, kind of like the invitation to shut down from that after effect and move away and into skeptical doubt, self-doubt, like, and I'm just starting to get it like, oh, I just have to wait for the after effect to calm. And it's, I can sit in it. So I wanted to offer that and see if you have any feedback.
Yeah. It's a good question. There's like what I appreciate you drawing out is that there's often a period where we can't tell, where we don't know if it's a bear or a taiko. And there are times when that's quite elongated. And, you know, it can be weeks of trying to be responsible, trying to manage our karma, and there's not resolution, right? We don't really know. And that's frequent that we run into that, and it's hard. It's great when turn on the light and that's what it is, done, right? There's still a little bit of a physical half-life that has to happen. But when there are these longer term, really amorphous questions, it's hard to sustain that. And I think this, acknowledging it, with yourself, so you're clear of what's happening and finding compassion that it takes a particular kind of energy and resources are getting diverted that are normally available, and you're not as capable as you might be.
Thank you.
This is Suho. I think when I started practice, I loved the hard. Like, I was very attracted to the hard. And it's taken a long time to, discern what's needed at the moment. What's needed? Do I need to lean in? Do I need ease? Can you say a little bit about why all the hard then in the old stories I'm hoping it's something more than just, oh, it was cultural and, you know, that's what they thought is the thing you needed. But can you say a little bit more about, I don't need more encouragement to do hard, but that, what might I learn there?
Well, I think the basic pivot of I'm willing is actually hard, right? Like it's threatening for life to be vibrant, because we have this sense of who we are that is going to be disrupted, which is like, if we can relax into it, it's really quite accurate and appropriate. But before that, it's really terrifying. And so having these images of difficulty is a way of like acknowledging that, is a way of kind of giving yourself something to like, oh, right, I'm really gonna have to push. I'm really gonna have to like, you know, dig deep. So that may be inspirational, it may not be, but I think at some point it was probably pretty inspirational.
This is Tony. Excuse me. I have a question about finding a balance in Zazen with ease, with taking things easily and with having to push. I come from a background where I spent an awful lot of years just beating myself up, you know, in sitting, trying to get somewhere, trying to do the right thing, all of that pattern, right? And I'm finding that it's very important for equanimity to be able to just, you know, pivot on a dime. Okay, that was there. Just drop it, let it go, see what's happening. And I'm finding it quite difficult to find a balance between that, which is fine, and just goofing off, which is not fine. So could you say a bit more about that, please?
Sure. Well, you know, you've been doing this a long time. I got a lot out of trying too hard, right? Like it was really useful for me for quite some time. At some point, it became a lot less useful for me. And partly that's maturity, and just like getting better at this. What's useful changes over time. I think moments of transformation, like when we can really pivot, when we can really like see something quite differently, like that rarely happens when we're comfortable, right? It rarely happens when we're like completely balanced. Maybe that's enough.
Do you have any tips about how not to just goof off? Because that's
any tips about
how not to just, how to tell the difference between, okay, I'm accepting this, whatever it is, and okay, I mean, and you know, that's a, and just, it's a loss of awareness.
Yeah.
I don't know how to, I'm having trouble catching that.
Well, if my mind is wandering, if I'm like caught by something, usually there's like there's a somatic sense of like angularity, right? Like there's like a tug kind of. If I'm aware, I'm just kind of resting in mindfulness. Like thoughts may be sort of passing through, but there's not that tug. And so I would, you know, like, I'm not sure what your cue will be, but that's one that I use.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. Thank you for your talk. And I'm really glad that guy pulled you out of the water so you could come tell that story today. It just made me think of how important your life is and our lives are, to be able to tell these stories. And now you're mature and you tell that story probably differently than you did 20 years ago. But I see the maturity in your practice, and I'm really happy for the reasons that everybody came here, whatever reason, to notice that this is our precious life. The thing that hit me was in our practice, in our insecurities, in things that come up for us, I realized that being a woman in particular, that we were taught by society or culture, Japanese culture teaches a certain way for women to be in particular, mm-hmm. American culture does, that we're taught to behave, we're taught to get along, we're taught to be nice, we're taught to smile, we're taught to fit in. Mm-hmm. So that is a lot of what we bring in, our anxiety to bringing into practice is like, oh, when I come to the Zendo, I need to behave. I need to be a good Buddhist. Mm-hmm. I need to sit still, mm-hmm. Whether male or female. But particularly being a female, I noticed it really kind of hurts my heart when I see young women trying so hard to behave. But there's also a vulnerability in it. There's a vulnerability in speaking right now. I'm nervous, but I feel it's important to share that that our society is hard on young people, hard on women, hard on disabled people, hard on, in so many ways. But these stories help bringing the story of your personal vulnerability and your personal anxieties and so on, and the fears that we all face. It's just interesting that I was, to piggyback off what she was saying, like the fine line of figuring out when to be casual, when to be formal, when mm-hmm. to wear a robe and sit, and you're a symbol of something that people look to, but you're out playing basketball in jeans and a tank top, or shorts and a tank top. Like that symbolism and those forms, that formality has a place, right? And then sometimes it's easier to, be more casual. And I'm wondering if that's the same for our anxieties and our fears and our perceptions of what people think of us and how we can approach our lives knowing those things.
Well, thank you for meeting yourself and speaking up. Yeah, I feel like really it's such an individual question, and it's so, I really don't want to say how to do it, because I have answers that have worked for me, and we're all so unique, we're all so specific, and we have such specific little microclimates that we're existing in, and I really want to appreciate that richness and discover what works for different people. So I just want to meet that with openness rather than trying to give a direction.
Hi, this is Yukio. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the coexistence, it appears, of practicing no preference and also getting to know oneself or something along those lines. I find that actually a little bit confusing. Could you draw out some of that?
Yeah, maybe. I think, yeah, it should be confusing. That's a good sign. I think again, there's not going to be a map, But what I would say is that, it's very layered. And so if we kind of do a scan of like, how am I acting out? Like, there's probably like three or four things you could notice right now, like in the last 24 hours, where like, oh yeah, like that's one. And so, oh, okay, great. Like you've got like the current menu of like, okay, what are like, what am I noticing? What am I trying to bring more clarity to, more sensitivity to? And like there's a coarseness, like a level of like how fine, how coarse is the like I want that. I think what will happen is that we get used to noticing like presence or absence of attachment, and it's different from preference, right? There's a and one way that I test it for myself is like let's say it's like this is the weather, right? And preference wise I like this weather. Like if it was raining, like would I tighten around that? Like I have a preference, but I'm not really attached to it, right? Like I'm pretty much excited by the weather most of the time. Like, oh, I get to play in that is pretty standard response. Yeah. Is that helpful?
Yes, and could I try a follow up?
Yeah.
I think was thinking more about like self-expression, which maybe is not as related. Maybe that's kind of a different.
Okay. Well, I think one of the places I go there for myself in navigating is like first cease from evil, then do good, right? And so like try to land stillness first. And if out of that something arises, then I can move forward with that. And if I'm not doing the first part, it's probably not a great idea. So like if I'm caught by something, if I'm pretty sure that's a bear, it's probably not a good idea to like give a Dharma talk on bears, right? Like it's not the time.
Hey, Satan here. Thank you for your talk. You talked about this sort of koan or this balance between safety and comfortability, and that one does not always equal the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels really important to me. It made me think of this training that I got to do in primary attachment therapy. Mm-hmm. And there's something that they kind of taught us about doing a safety protocol where like anxiety and uncomfortability is coming up. You sort of check in around like, oh, like what is the bad thing that could happen right now? And is that actually happening? I used that to various degrees in working with other people, but then actually just yesterday I had this experience of my own anxiety and nervousness coming up without a seemingly good cause and exploring that and finding, at least for me, that to be really useful.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, like what am I actually afraid of happening in this moment?
Yeah.
And I couldn't give like a great answer. And like, I noticed it even actually in like talking to me. I was like, oh, like what am I like afraid of? And like having a microphone, like, speaking to a crowd. It's like, oh, okay. Maybe that I say something ignorant or that like I fumble over my words, or, and then I'm like judged. And okay, like, but like, what is actually happening in this moment, and like, how am I meeting it? And it's not that it doesn't make it comfortable immediately, mm-hmm. but it reminds me that there is a kind of safety amidst that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I just wonder about how that might apply in like places of meditation.
Well, I think, you know, what that, my interpretation of that, like, technique is it's just like engaging our interest, our like ability to orient in a wholesome way, right? And so it's interrupting the story of threat and allowing something fresh to come in, right? And so like that interruption itself is really valuable. Like our sense of who we are is really fed by like thought linking to thought linking to thought. And so if we like are able to insert something fresh there, it really feels good.
Yeah, that you said that and I was like, oh, that actually lines up with what my experience of it was, which was sort of this like, oh wait, like kind of like, oh, I can't. Yeah. And then
it's like one of the things which is like it doesn't quite seem fair about Buddhism is that or reality, depending on how you parse it, is that like a moment of presence is just like reliably pleasant, right? Of just giving awareness to like whatever our experience is, there's something pleasant about that. Like make use, like we all have access to that.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Alice. Thank you for your talk. I feel like with the Ongo and the Sesshin practice, I feel it's more for monks and nuns more than the lay people, because I feel like for us to sign up for a Sesshin, it's like 180 degree difference just to come here and do the Sesshin. And I remember the first time I came here, it's like, wow, the schedule is so particular. Like, what am I even doing here? It's kind of like at work. Like, why am I here? And I think the Sangha is very, very supportive, but I could not stop my inner voice. Mm-hmm. It's like people wake me up, not the food I want. I want my own bed. I want my own room. It's like keep criticizing myself and judging myself. And I wonder whether you have some like tips or advice for people like some of us that maybe practice not that long, but keep coming back to Sesshin or signing up, in addition to telling me that Alice keep coming back, keep signing up. So maybe more practical tips.
Nice. I appreciate that. I would say that it's probably not that different.
Can you say more?
For someone who's coming in from like a lay environment, from someone who's like living here full time, like Sesshin is hard. Like Sesshin is a lot of not doing things your way, of bowing to the form, the scheduled food, the like activity, the whatever, the people around you. So that's the same, that's shared. Over time, you do get better at it. Like it's easier. Oh shoot, I lost it. There was something else too I wanted to say. Heck. I don't know. There's more, but if I remember, I'll tell you later.
Okay. I will give my best to try signing up again. Thank you.
Okay, on Zoom, there's a comment from Patrick. He says, I appreciate that you haven't set rules for asceticism as if it had concrete existence. In America, unlike medieval Japan, almost every one of us comes from a different culture, despite the mythology of a standard paradigm for being an American. I might have a WASP background, but the person next to me might be raised atheist in a commune. The person on the other side might be an immigrant from another country. He says, I think I'm trying to say it's a caution about judgment of others' manners as well.
You're here.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Benny. I'm curious about meeting other people's practice. I think for me, when I meet somebody that's a little bit more stiff, or I perceive them as being stiff, or they correct me, I'm like, chill out. Like, yo, this is not that serious. Don't even be so dogmatic. And there's the other side of me when I see like people, they don't do it. I'm like, you gotta take this more seriously. Like, you didn't bow to your seat. I'm like, what are you doing? So I'm curious, like, how do we meet that? Because I can feel fine about meeting my own practice, making my own mistakes and kind of goofing off and then being serious. But when it comes to other people, I get like so stiff and then loose about it.
Well, that it's a great, excellent timing with Patrick's question. There was a period in residency where Sekishin was living there, and like his byline was like, do your own practice. And which was basically like, don't judge me. but it was really good medicine for the resident crew that was there at the time. This was a long time ago. But that's hard, like to really, take responsibility for ourselves and to trust that like everyone is also doing that. Everyone's also like doing that discernment for their own life. And they might be in a really different situation or have really different values or capacities than we do. And, I find that like, there's a real habit to try to simplify, to try to like make the situation easier to understand. And, it's more beautiful when I don't, right? When it's more complex, when it's more differentiated. And so like, there's more effort to hold that possibility, but it's much more pleasant.